Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Bruin Podcast, where we discuss US politics with none other than Barack Obama, US Ambassador to Germany, John Emerson. And on that basis, we talk a little on German and Brexit matters too. A really fascinating 25 minutes. We really hope you enjoy it. And a huge thank you to Capital Group for helping arrange the interview. But before we get to that, please listen to some very important disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Bruin podcast and a very special recording. We're delighted to welcome back actually to this recording John Emerson, who has a long and illustrious CV and career. I think the sort of highlight that we would pick out for the context of this conversation is his role in the Obama administration as US ambassador to Germany. John, very welcome you're very welcome back to the Bruin podcast, and we're delighted that you've flown in specifically for this this recording. How are you, first of all?
Well, I'm doing great. This is actually the end of 3 weeks in Europe and about 4 days here in the UK in London, and it's great to be here. It's great to be back with you.
We're delighted that you've been able to tag on some other events along with this.
Well, you know, this was the reason for my trip for sure. It's anything to see you again.
So in terms of content, I thought given your role in that as ambassador to the US, but for the Democrat Party, it'd be good to focus on how the Democrat candidates are sort of shaping up, who the front runners are. What are they sort of proposing, and you know what it may mean for us as investors, and then eventually how they may fare in the presidential election. Of course, the impeachment issue is sort of being writ large at the moment, but also at the back end of this conversation, want to leverage those your deep understanding of German politics and what that may mean. There's a lot of talk about fiscal stimulus and how Germany is approaching Brexit, supposed to be our very good friends in those negotiations. So anyway, with all of that, we'll try and get that done in sort of 20, 25 minutes. So let's kick off then with who you see as the front runners in the primary for the, in the Democrat primaries.
Well, the front runners are obvious. It would be Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden at this point, with Bernie Sanders slipping.
But health issues there as well.
A health issue. First of all, Elizabeth Warren's been eating the food off his plate for a good year now.
Right. Okay.
You know, Bernie put a bunch of issues in play, like, free college education, Medicare for all, relieve everybody of any health care related debts. And Elizabeth Warren's going, yep, me too. Yep, me too. Yeah, me too. And then she does. But I also have a more detailed plan for how to implement it. So she's been sort of chewing away at the Bernie Sanders base. And then with his heart attack, I think you've seen a big shift where a lot of Sanders supporters are in all likelihood going to shift to Warren. So let me just caution you on this front runner thing. We're 4 months away from the beginning of the Iowa caucuses. If you were to look at this point in time 4 years ago, Jeb Bush was going to be president of the United States. If you were to look at it 12 years ago, Barack Obama was nowhere. In fact, there were articles, what happened to Obama? You know, he was kind of disappointing. He started out so well. And by the way, in campaign where I was actively involved in 1992, Bill Clinton had not announced until next week. So I just want really what happened, what will happen in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, Nevada, those four early states, is going to completely either turn this thing on its head or result in a situation that just locks in the two or three people who are the front runners. So I just caution people not to read too much into these polls.
I mean, where is the vulnerability then for a new contender to emerge? Do you think it's actually that Elizabeth Warren has this progressive left sleeve sort of sewn up, and actually maybe the moderate Joe Biden is looking a bit more vulnerable? Is there scope for sort of more of a moderate?
Well, there are two tensions going on in the Democratic Party right now. And clearly the gravitational pull in the party is toward the left, in part as a reaction to Donald Trump being so far to the right.
Yeah.
But the first tension is between center left, far progressive left. And clearly Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are the avatars of this far progressive left wing, and clearly Joe Biden is sort of best known on the center left. And the argument is the progressives say, we need to do the same thing Donald Trump did. We need to energize our base, get them to turn out in unprecedented numbers, and that's how we're going to win. And the centrists say, you know, the problem with that is that's all very nice, but if you energize the base, guess what? The base lives in states largely that are already blue states. And the key is not the popular vote. The key is the electoral vote in a handful of states where whether we win or lose is going to depend on how do we do with moderates and independents. And if somebody too far to the left could scare them away. So that's the Biden electability argument. And but you have that tension going on. And I agree with you. I think it's pretty clear Elizabeth Warren, it's pretty hard to see her be challenged as the leader in that lane, even though there's also a generational struggle going on. There's younger Democrats in both lanes that are sort of pushing up and go, yeah, but we need a new generation of leadership. These guys are all septuagenarians. But it's hard to see her getting challenged. And I think you're right. I think Biden in that more center-left lane perhaps is a bit more vulnerable to a challenge. But the key demographic to look at is the African-American vote. Right now, first of all, the African-American vote in Democratic primaries, 27-28% of the primary vote. And in a number of states, particularly as you move through the South, whoever wins the African-American vote is going to win that state. They're going to win that primary. And right now, that vote is pretty clearly behind Joe Biden, with people like Kamala Harris from California or Cory Booker from New Jersey getting a little bit of support, but it's pretty much behind Joe Biden and not Elizabeth Warren at all. And so the question is, if Biden can hold that, it's hard to see a Warren getting the nomination without breaking into the African-American vote. She gets some younger people, but that's a challenge that she has.
I mean, delighted to hear your own opinion. I mean, I have one isolated source in reference to bookmakers, a UK domestic bookmaker, who has pinned Elizabeth Warren as now higher probability than Joe Biden. I don't know what the data is telling you. I know we must caution the data, given how much time there is to run. But are you sort of saying, as it stands, Biden, and given the sort of African-American cohort, it's looking like Biden is the most likely victim?
I would say, as it stands, Warren has the momentum today,
yeah,
for sure, and Biden has vulnerability today. But I would put it for sure at 50-50, no better for Warren than 50-50, and maybe even a little less, because she's about to go into a new experience for her. She has never been attacked in these debates. She's never had people come after her for, candidly, some very unrealistic and very expensive policy positions that don't have a snowball's chance of hell at getting enacted, because the Republicans undoubtedly will still, if they don't hold on to the Senate, they're going to have enough support in the Senate to make it hard to get some of these policies enacted. She's going to be attacked for that. And we don't know how she'll do in that response. Now, she may do very, very well, in which case she would continue her momentum, or she might falter a little bit under what will be withering attacks from the Democrats in the next few rounds of debates. And then just wait until the Republican slime machine gets a hold of her. We'll be hearing all about Pocahontas again and things like that. So,
I mean, her credit, she seems to have done very well in these TV debates today.
She has, in part because she's only once has she been on the stage with her main competitors. The first two debates, she was on the stage with a bunch of lesser lights, and then you had Sanders and Biden and Harris on the stage together. Just the way that they randomly, you know, picked these candidates to go. Remember when they split them up. In the last debate, she was on the stage, but there was so much of attacking on Joe Biden, she sort of got off scot-free. I don't think that's any longer going to be the case.
I mean, I've clearly misdiagnosed how the U.S. Presidential election is sort of won and lost, I suspect, based on your African-American analysis. But before
that's just the Democratic
primary. Right, okay. Well, when it comes to the... Sorry, okay. So when it comes to the...
And just to put a pin in that one, that's how Hillary beat Bernie.
Yeah.
That's how Barack beat Hillary. Was with there were a relatively close... contest that went all the way to the end. Barack and Hillary each had a couple hundred more delegates than the other one. If you work it backwards and see where did they come from, it was largely because of overwhelming support that both candidates had in those two elections from the African-American vote, which tends to be, it's not a monolithic community, but they tend to be pretty loyal and as voters.
Well, on that case, I mean, just sort of running forward to November next year, no matter who is in wins the Democrat candidacy, it would sort of be my rough assumption that could be way off the mark is that, you know, the Rust Belt states have been a crucial determinant in getting Trump into the White House. And of course, he has some very sort of blunt solutions for that electorate in terms of, you know, their manufacturing base has been hollowed out because of, I don't know, sort of China or automation. Immigration, you know, what is it that the Democrats, be it Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or a new contender, are going to come up with in response to those blunt solutions from Trump to try and win those states back?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the Trump populist appeal is two-part. Part of it's economic, but also part of it's cultural. You know, the world's changing fast. It's changing because those other people are coming in and changing our country. And I'm gonna slow it down and help restore your way of life. The Elizabeth Warren approach in particular is also a populist approach, but it's economic populism. It's these guys on Wall Street have been making out like bandits at your expense. The middle class is being hollowed out because of the suits that are moving, you know, the business, you know, school suits that are recommending that, you know, factories be closed down and moved offshore. And you look at the global financial crisis, the people who created that, which resulted in your job loss, are now doing 10 times better than or 100 times better than you are. And we're going to put an end to that. So she is running a very populist kind of campaign as well. Biden, less populist, but no less appealing to working class voters. I'm working class Joe. I grew up, you know, in the middle of Pennsylvania. I've, you know, connected with labor and working class people my entire political life. I'm not some rich guy. On a visceral level, I'm one of you. And on a visceral level, he connects with them. Whereas Elizabeth Warren might come off a little bit too much like that Harvard professor that she is, and have less of a visceral connection to them, even though her message is more populist. So I would look at a Trump-Warren candidate. She's going to say, I'll see you and raise you one on your populism. You want to talk about getting tough on China? I'm going to get tough on China, but in a smarter way. You know, you want to talk about people losing their jobs? Well, guess what? And economic, you know, helping to restore the economic base of the middle class. You've done nothing to deal with the cost of higher education. You've done nothing to deal with the cost of health care. And all you've done is given the fat cats on Wall Street a tax cut. Yeah. So that's going to be her argument. Biden will be a little bit less strident, perhaps a little less threatening to moderates who maybe don't mind what Trump's done in terms of the economy, but they really hate his behavior and are concerned about the implications of that. So it's a little bit of a different approach, but that's how they will approach it. So don't assume, particularly if it's Elizabeth Warren, that Trump will own the populist argument.
I mean, looking at those sort of set of policies and not advocating any particular ideology, I mean, it's clear that the Warren victory has poses the most obvious threats to markets. What sort of what could be her success in terms of delivering on many of these policies? Now, we talked about healthcare for all. You seem very reticent, or you seemed skeptical that that could be delivered upon. But would she attempt to reverse tax cuts? You know, the China issue, and how much can she do as the executive versus, you know, Congress sort of standing in the way?
Well, we've seen during the Obama years for sure how the Senate can stand, if it's controlled by Republicans, can absolutely stand in the way of getting things done. I mean, Obama wasn't able to get anything done legislatively the last 2 years, and we've seen in the Trump years how even having a close Senate, it's hard to get things done. So the key is going to be, do the Democrats win the Senate or not? If the Democrats don't win the Senate, I think it's fair to say that much of the Elizabeth Warren agenda is going to have a very tough time getting implemented, apart from things she can do through executive action, regulations, that kind of thing, which, believe me, she will be doing. And she'll also be working to kind of unwind some of the regulatory relaxation that Trump has done. But I would, the area that she would have the Medicare for All, that's a huge, you're going to get rid of public, private health insurance. You're going to impose government-run system on everybody. That's a huge legislative leap. And that'd be very, very hard to implement, as an example. Tougher rules and regulations on Wall Street. Unwinding some of the Trump tax cuts, which you can do through the reconciliation process, which means you only need 50 votes in the Senate, not 60, which you would need for wholesale legislative changes like Medicare for All. That, I think, is more likely. You could see her coming in, unwinding some of the tax cut that corporations benefited from, that wealthy individuals benefited from, maybe restoring the Obama level top tax rates, maybe imposing this wealth tax that she's been talking about, and at the same time giving a much bigger tax break to the working middle class. I mean, that I think is probably one of the more likely things. From a regulatory standpoint, you know, if you're in the insurance industry, if you're in the healthcare industry, if you're in the pharmaceutical industry, if you're in the banking or financial world, watch out. She's going to be looking for ways to deliver on her campaign promises. And on trade negotiations, I mean, she has a lot of power to do what she's talking about, yeah. As would Biden, as would... Now, Biden would probably go back and try to redo TPP, which is a different approach on China, and I think ultimately maybe even a more effective approach, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement that Obama had negotiated. So, you know, you may see a different direction there. But on that, on foreign policy issues, on trade, the president has a lot of latitude.
Yeah, I mean, sort of adding that up, it seems as though there actually could be sort of a nice, relatively nice windfall for sort of lower income groups in the US. They have a higher propensity to spend, so that's sort of good news. But perhaps the big businesses that dominate the S&P, those tech businesses, and the banking sector could get a bit of a rough treatment. So
yeah,
I suspect, would you agree that the markets would be right to show some nervousness?
I forgot to mention tech. Absolutely. She's been already talking about breaking up some of the big companies. That's harder said than done. Yep. Although she could certainly, she's going to appoint an attorney general if she's president. She's going to appoint an assistant attorney general for antitrust, and certainly they could commence those kinds of things. But let me just say, we're getting way ahead of ourselves,
yeah, okay,
by having this long conversation about what an Elizabeth Warren presidency will be like, because I also think that that she could be in many respects more vulnerable to Donald Trump than, say, Joe Biden or even one of the, you know, younger candidates, should they get the nomination, would be as a general election candidate, because I think there's a lot. I mean, you mentioned at the big outset, you said there's a lot of what she's talking about and stands for, it's making people nervous. And believe me, by the time the Trump campaign, which is going to be extremely well-funded, gets done characterizing her and defining her, she's obviously would be doing it herself. It's going to be, there'll be increased nervousness about that candidacy.
Well, I'm desperate to talk about Germany, given your sort of close relations
sure.
there, and you've been on a very recent visit. But very briefly, if you may, make some comment on impeachment proceedings that Democrats sort of seem
yeah.
to be putting together
yeah.
and what the consequences might be.
Okay, number one, the president, if there were a vote today, the president would be impeached. You can be done on a party line basis in the House. You only need 218 votes, which is a simple majority. More than 218 Democratic members of Congress have said we want to pursue at least the impeachment investigation. I think if today, given the behavior of the president and stonewalling all the investigations, if they had to vote, they would vote to impeach. Number two, there's no way on God's green earth he's going to be thrown out of office other than through an election, at least in this cycle. And the reason for that is once you're impeached, then you go on to trial in the Senate. And that trial, you get convicted as president and then thrown out of office with 2/3 of the vote. That would mean that 20 Republican senators, many of whom represent ruby red states where Trump is very popular, would have to flip on Trump and vote to throw him out of office. And even Republican senators that are concerned because they're vulnerable, like there are 3 or 4 potential pickups for the Democrats in this election, Colorado, Maine, Arizona. Those folks have an easy out. They can simply say, you know, I'm deeply concerned by what the president did. I think it's incredibly inappropriate. But come on, folks, we have an election in 6 months, 7 months, whatever the time frame is. Let's let the American people decide. They've heard enough about this. We'll let them decide. So there's no way he leaves. So then the question is, and by the way, the sooner that trial is over, then he gets to run around and say, I've been completely exonerated. You know, I'm innocent. These people have been foot dragging and attacking me and witch hunt, first Mueller investigation in Russia and blah, blah, blah. Right. You can see how that will play out. And so the impeachment process is, I think, quite risky for the Democrats. The only reason Nancy Pelosi and some of the moderate Democrats in the House who were against pursuing impeachment before this Ukraine call came out are now for it is it is a very narrow, simple, easy for normal people to understand dynamic here. It is basically President of the United States called the leader of another country, threatened to withhold aid unless that leader instituted an investigation against his principal political opponent. That most people viscerally get that that is not okay. And so if the Democrats can, even if Trump doesn't get thrown out of office, if they can keep this narrowly focused on that issue, number one, they'll probably get a couple of Republican votes. Mitt Romney in the Senate, for instance, is made pretty clear he's not happy with the president on this. They may get a couple of Republican votes, so they could say, all right, we didn't convict him, but it was bipartisan. And it may be an issue that raises enough concern about the president that would be harmful to him. And more importantly, from the standpoint of the Constitution, it sets a precedent. Don't do this kind of behavior, or at a minimum, you're going to go down in history as, at this point, one of the 3 presidents who's ever been impeached. But if the Democrats cannot contain themselves, and if they allow all this other kitchen sink stuff to come into it, and it looks like a "we hate Donald Trump" harangue, and the longer it goes, the more it's likely to benefit Trump, which is why I believe the White House strategy is to stonewall everything, force the Democrats in Congress to
reel them in,
subpoena, to sue. It'll go into courts and may go up to the Supreme Court. This thing may be that you may not hear any evidence for another 3-4 months. And the other thing Trump's doing during this time frame with his comment about, yeah, China should investigate the Bidens, is trying to normalize this behavior, which, by the way, is completely abnormal for any president to do, but trying to normalize it and talk about it enough so people go, oh, well, you know, yeah, that's what presidents do. And by the way, he's normalized a lot of behavior that's never been done by a president before.
Well, I mean, I'd love to talk about that some more, but we must spend a bit of time on Germany. Just, are you visiting Berlin this trip? Have you?
Yeah, I've already been there. I had several meetings with senior government officials, And I had was fortunate enough to be invited to a dinner with the chancellor in New York right before I came over here with about 10 people. We had about a 3.5 hour dinner conversation on that.
So some pretty useful contact, as far as this conversation is concerned. Okay, so the key questions for us is, what is Germany, how is German policymakers going to react to a domestic economy that's sort of stuttering at the moment?
Well, I talked a lot, I met with the deputy finance minister and with spent some time with Angela Merkel's top economic advisor. And the answer is there are steps that Germany can take and would be willing to take once the economy turns. But it is highly unlikely they're going to do anything as a prophylactic measure to try to prevent the economy from turning. And there's sort of two key issues. There's Die Schwarze Null, the Black Zero, which is a balanced budget, which is part of the coalition agreement. Okay, well, that's a political issue. If the political dynamic changes, the government, you know, the coalition partners can certainly make a change in that particular provision. And then secondly, you have this debt brake in the German Constitution, which would require 2/3 of the vote of the Bundestag to overturn or to modify, because it is part of the Constitution. But the debt brake itself has a formula built into it that once the economy turns, there's more flexibility for fiscal stimulus. And so that's why it's unlikely for something to happen until that happens. And you still have a legitimate dispute within Germany about it. Well, how necessary is this? How effective would it be, et cetera? The other thing to keep in mind is we don't know today how long this coalition government's going to last. And the reason is, the coalition partners, Merkel's coalition partners, the Social Democrats, are in the middle of a very tough and energetic leadership battle. And there are now 7 teams of candidates. They've decided to do man-woman teams for running for leadership of the Social Democratic Party. And only one of the teams, the one that is led by Olaf Scholz, who's the current finance minister and vice chancellor, sort of leader of the Social Democrats in the coalition government, that's the only one that has said, we will keep the coalition intact if I win. And so if he loses, somebody else gets in all likelihood, the coalition blows up sometime in December or early January. And then, you know, Merkel made it pretty clear that if that happens, she's not going to govern as a leader of a minority government, and there will be new elections. So I can guarantee you nothing's going to be happening until this is resolved.
Okay, so a large fiscal stimulus seems a bit of a moonshot at this stage. I mean, interesting that...
Yeah, I wouldn't be betting on that.
It's interesting, despite that sort of potential political discontinuity in Germany, there is no threat in there of Euroscepticism, is there? This is the people we're talking about are sort of Europhile sort of supporters. But
100%, as is Ursula von der Leyen, who's the new, will be the new president of the European Commission.
And so... On the context of Germany supposed to be, or reportedly being, you know, the UK's best friend in Brexit negotiations, I mean, this week it's become pretty clear that Germany's position is one that sort of stands behind the, you know, Michel Barnier, the standard sort of European line. You don't see any deviation from that?
No, I mean, I would have said, I think the German attitude after the Brexit vote and during, say, the first year and a half or maybe more of the negotiations, which have been going on forever, was we need to structure a deal that keeps the UK as closely tied as possible to the common market. And by the way, if the longer we wait, it makes it more likely that there's another referendum. Wouldn't that be nice? I think now the view is, you know, the UK is a house divided, probably needs to exit. As you know, rather than have another referendum or something, and because Ireland, of course, is one of the 27, and because the EU is a consensus organization, unless the Irish government says, "Oh, it's okay to do away with this backstop," the backstop is going to persist one way or the other. And I honestly, that's not a shock. I don't understand why Boris Johnson believed that, you know, well, if he just got in there and threatened a hard crash out Brexit, that the EU would fold. There's no indication it'll fold. And I'll tell you something else. if you were to ask, you know, Merkel or Macron or any number of the European leaders about where does Brexit stand on your worry list, probably number four or five. Whereas in the first year or so after the vote, I think for all of them, it would have been number one. And so, I think that's kind of where we are in terms of Boris Johnson's conversation with Angela Merkel, where he basically threw her under the bus by saying that, she said there's no way, never was going to be any way that, you know, we would reach an agreement with you. I'm sure she's very happy with that, and that will make for a good long-term relationship between the two of them. And you could just tell with her spokesman's response, we do not disclose the contents of private conversations with other world leaders. But beyond that, knowing her, I know her well enough that she probably did not say that. What she probably did was try to give him some guidance and say, look, as a practical matter, if you want to get a deal done, here's the way to do it. And the here's the way to do it is, it's got to look, smell, it needs to address the same issues that the backstop addressed. I mean, maybe you put the border in the Irish Sea, but it's got to address those same issues. And then he took that as, because of course he doesn't want to do that, they said, she told me that's never going to work.
Yeah, it seems unlikely Boris is accepting much counsel outside of his immediate advisor team.
Yeah, that's probably right.
But John, thank you so much for taking the time. A really fascinating conversation covering lots of ground. And so we really, really appreciate that content. And we wish you sort of all the success on your trip. And we look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you very much.
In the future and reviewing some of those comments.
And I know I'm going to be seeing you in sometime in November. Yeah, you can review, run the tape and say, well, he was wrong about this. He was wrong about that.
I'm sure there's a much higher success rate.
So I'll have to make the caveat. But I could be wrong.
Okay, we've made that sensible conclusion. To our listeners, thanks very much for your time. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. But whichever platform you listen to us through, please let us know what you think. But until next time, many thanks for listening.